up, peeps? 1 o'clock on the East Coast, the final trading day of the month of March, the final day trading day of the first quarter of 2024. March 28th, it's Thursday. Tomorrow's a holiday. Dan Nathan, soon to be joined by the Carter Braxton Worth. And of course, if it's Thursday, it's John Butters. See what I did there, Dan?
Good Thursday, buddy. I mean, listen, it kind of feels like a quiet, this is just one of those other days. I don't know. Maybe it's the 1 o'clock hour where just things feel pretty calm here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? You know, like we are literally dead flat in the S&P 500 here. And, you know, it's just like, it feels like it's like a Groundhog Day a little bit, you know?
Well, interesting you say that because, you know, we've had this steady stream and it does appear to be each day sort of mirrors the prior day. But within that, we try to find some nuggets that we can bring forth. So with that said, let's pull up the rundown, shall we? Because we're off to the best start for stocks since 19. Now, I don't know if that's 2019 or 1919. My sense it's 2019, though. Carter's going to do a chart check on the big banks. And we're going to do a little check on the consumer. And of course, as I mentioned, John Butters, if it's Thursday, it's Butters, Dan.
You know it. You know, so this is a headline guy. This is one of the first things I read this morning in the Wall Street Journal.
And it was WSJ. About,
yep, that's what it comes out as. Yeah. And, you know, I thought this was kind of interesting because I was I did a pod last week with the Compound Bros. You know those guys, Downtown Josh Brown and Mike Batnick. And we were talking a little bit about, you know, Fed Chair Powell, and he, you know, got us off of ZIRP, and they started raising interest rates. And, you know, in 2018, you know, they kind of like, I don't know, what do you call, what do you call that they did when they were like on autopilot? The stock market sold off how much in Q4?
19.9%. And then they subsequently cowered to the basically two different things, the forces of the market, which were clearly working against them.
Yep.
Although I think the market would have figured it out. And obviously the Trump administration, which was seemingly on a daily basis, browbeating them into submission, which again is not political. It just happens to be fact. So those two things got them to sort of a reverse course. And then obviously 2019 was sort of off to the races.
Well, right. So let's just pull up a chart. We have one of the S&P 500 where it came from an all-time high at the time, and it dropped, like you said, 19.9%. Let's go to the other chart really quickly here. And we have that period circled. I mean, that, you know, like, look at that. And then look over to the right, and you see that 35% drop. That was when we had a global pandemic, when the world shut down. So think about that, because the Fed was raising interest rates a quarter point every other meeting, right? And then all of a sudden, there was a growth scare. And I bring up the conversation I had with Josh and Batnick last week, because we were they started talking about how 2019 was amazing. We were talking about how what happens when, all right, so let's go to this other chart. Let's show Fed funds. Let's look and see what the Fed was doing in the lead up to that, right? So that stair-step function, they paused. And so they were making the case, well, when actually that narrative that when the Fed starts to cut, it's actually really good for markets. Well, of course it is if you just drop 20% in a straight line in 2 months, right? I mean, talk to me a little bit about that. Maybe they want to toggle back and forth.
You know, see. That's exactly. And look, you know, those guys are great. They are. I mean, and they're spot on in their longer term assessment of what the year brought forth. But what's not taken into consideration is what happened prior to that. Now, if your timeline is years and not days or weeks or whatever,
yeah,
then okay, you know, that's a conversation. However, if you're trying to focus on the here and now, I mean, what that effectively is telling you with their periods of time. When, I mean, you can go back to 1987, for example. I mean, if you recall, you know, that October was a disaster. And then in the subsequent months, we got back. It's just, can you weather the storm, I guess, is your point. So, you know, I think,
well,
you
I don't
know, you circled that.
That's my point. I was like, I don't think that's a good comparison, that the Fed felt very comfortable about raising interest rates, normalizing interest rates. The stock market was off to the races, making new highs. And then all of a sudden it starts going down for whatever the reason. We don't pretend to have, you know what I mean? Like a crystal ball here. We don't know what the reason that's going to cause it.
Right.
20% sell off. One will come, people. Again, I don't know when, you know, I don't know what the reason is going to be, but it's also interesting to note that you spent some time, you know, talking about the yield curve inversion. You know what also happened in 2019? the first yield curve inversion of the 2-10s that we had in a very long time. And then, you know, so what did the Fed have to do? Well, you saw what they had to do. They had to stop raising, and then they started to effectively lower pretty aggressively. So I don't know, man. I just think it's kind of interesting, though.
There's so many things that are similar between so many different periods of time. You go back to the early, I mean, you know, you can go back to the early 70s and you can probably spot four or five different points in time since that sort of mirror what's going on now, but none of them are sort of a perfect comp, which I think is one of the reasons why, and I can't speak for everybody, it's probably why it's had me so confused. But to your point, you know, there are similarities for sure, but you know, the inverted yield curve, which for whatever reason people have seemingly forgot, maybe because it's gotten so old in the tooth that there are other things to talk about now, but it hasn't gone away. And as Elizabeth has said, you know, now we're longer than the 78 or 78 to 80 or 79 to 81 period of time, yeah, in terms of the inversion. And again, it's not the inversion that sort of gets you. That's the warning sign. It's the re-steepening, which, by the way, we really show no signs of. We saw it earlier this year. I think we got down to about 13-ish basis points or so inverted, you know, and now we've been sort of hovering between sort of 35 and 45. So, you know, that's out there as well.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, let's do a little sector check, and Amanda's going to pull this up. One of the things that was kind of interesting, we spent some time talking with Elizabeth yesterday, that would be EY from SoFi, on some of the energy stocks, the divergence between the commodity. This is something that you previewed, Guy. You previewed on the Insta. Believe it or not, Guy Adami has an Instagram. Sure. Account. It's guy.adami. You can also follow Risk Social Media on there. And Guy and I, each morning, we do a little preview of something that we're focused on. Maybe they can pull up this sector view by quarter to date, or well, there it is, just year to date, if you just want to sort it by, you know, like the best to worst, that sort of thing here. But it's interesting, Guy, your XLE is up 12% year to date. Look at that thing. And again, this thing was left for dead about 3 or 4 months ago.
If we pull up an individual XLE chart longer term, and yeah, and you look at it, it favors nicely to the communication services. Think about that for a second. Yeah. I don't think, if you didn't see this, you'd be like, there's no freaking way that can be the case. But you know what? It actually is the case. But you know, you look at an XLE chart and people have really sort of shit on energy for a while. And I understand it. But what you realize is, well, wait a second. It's actually sort of hanging in here pretty well. And now you go back longer term, you can see where we are and sort of where the prior all times high are. And you say, you know, maybe there is something here. Now, obviously, you know, we talk about it, the XLE basically comprised mostly of Conoco, Exxon, and Chevron. I get it. If you look at those individually, they've starting to get off the mat as well. And I do think it's an underappreciated space. And I will continue to say, you know, this has been performing. Obviously, the underlying commodity is helping, but it's performing in the wake of, you know, technology that's doing well. If there ever was a sell-off in technology, and obviously that's a huge if, you know, I do think the rotation will find its way into a number of different sectors, but I think energy is going to be one of them for sure.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned this one because, again, I think in this latest move, if you just look what you know, up 12%, let's say year to date, you know, you've had some big parts of the technology, like, you know, money has come out of Apple. It's probably finding its way, obviously, into some of these semis, but into some other areas. I want to pull up the XLC for a second. So that's the communication services select. Largest holdings there, Meta, Alphabet, Disney, Verizon, AT&T. What's interesting to me about this, not a bad looking chart whatsoever. Let's look at a 5-year chart right here. So this thing's been consolidating a little bit after that nice move higher over the last, you know, it's not above its 2021 highs. Like, that's pretty fascinating to me, Guy. Don't you think so? Now, again, we know that Google has kind of lagged some of the others. Meta is all the way back there. So that's just one to keep an eye on.
Yeah,
there.
100%. And there are a few, you know, we actually mentioned the transports. Like, if you look at this, this is the XLC. So just keep that visual for a second. I don't know if Amanda can do this, although she's great at this. I don't know if you can overlay XLC with IYT, but what I'll tell you is they're going to look eerily similar. Obviously, two entirely different things, but you know, you look at that right there. I mean, right, Dan? I mean, it's in terms of the levels and in terms of the moves, it's amazing how similar these look. And you have, again, the IYT trading up to that prior high, seemingly stalling out, and you have the XLC trading up to that prior high around the same time, and seemingly, again, I'm not saying that they're at all related whatsoever, it's not my point, but when you see things like this, it's like, oh, wait a second, no, maybe there is something interesting going on. So I'm glad Amanda was able to do that, because to say it is one thing, but to see it is something entirely different.
Well, let's do this. I mean, because we have Carter Braxton Worth waiting in the wings for
us. Come on.
We really appreciate it. I'd love Amanda to pull up the 5-year IYT while we bring Carter in. CBW.
Man,
how
are you, sir? Dubs. XLC. Yeah, that's a funny little, I say little, of course, because it's such a small area of the market, and two stocks are 50% weight, right? So a curious thing, but not quite back to the highs. We shall see.
Well, it's interesting that it's not back to the highs. And I think it was interesting that guy brought up the transports. Let's pull up the 5-year chart of the transports really quickly here, because guy, you know, this thing has come from, you know, the low 50s to just above 70. Guy's point is that it is still below those 2021 and those early 2022 highs. When you look at something like this, it's made back a lot of ground. I mean, what could possibly be the impetus to break this thing out and establish a new range above a 3-year range? I mean, like, after all the distance that it's come in such a short period of time, Carter.
Yeah, so it's a curious, if you look at the weightings here too, of course, you got the big package haulers, FedEx and UPS, which have struggled. The big rails are very large weight in Union Pacific, Norfolk Southern, CSX. Airlines are smaller. But they're in there and they've recovered a bit. So indexes are a curious thing, how you net them out. Is this, is it an important level? Sure. Is the presumption made that it will break out? Yes. But is it got the oomph and the torque to really push higher, 85, 95? I don't think so.
Yeah,
so,
Guy, when you and Charles Dow came up, I think it was your senior thesis for the Dow transport theory.
He did most of the work.
He did most of the work. I mean, it's interesting. Do you place any, is the fact that we haven't had a new high in the Dow transports, and we've had S&P making new highs, what, we've had 20 new highs year to date. Does that mean anything? And again, I joke because I, you know, you're a few years older than me, but that has been a 100-year-old idiom, isn't it, in the markets?
Yeah. And listen, when it was created, obviously our economy here in the United States was much different. So transports, I think, were far more important than they probably are now. I mean, it's a different economy in so much that technology sort of taking the lead in other sectors as well. With all that said, transports are probably one of the most economically sensitive areas out there. So you can't just discount it entirely. And I don't think people are doing that, but they're clearly not wanting to focus on them because they really have, you know, again, they haven't performed to the extent that the broader market in the form of the S&P and the Qs have performed. So it's something to keep in mind. And now you look at the components of the IYT. I mean, it's the Us. It's Union Pacific, it's UPS, it's Uber, it's probably United Airlines somewhere in there. And to Carter's point, you know, to get that oomph to go from sort of 70 to 85, I mean, it's going to take a Herculean effort, I think. And it's just something to sort of have out there and watch is my point. Yeah. And, you know, the transports, again, they have not participated nearly the extent that some of the other things have.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, Carter, and I know it kind of gets Guy a little aggravated here and there. For years and years, you know, you have folks come on CNBC or whatever, and they talk about the financials. And you know, when we can talk about technology, you know, we can say that, you know, it's a pretty wide swath of companies that make up technology, which is why we spend a lot of time talking about software and semis and the like here. But some of the work that I love that you do, because you're not focused obviously on the fundamentals, is that you take a group, the way it's grouped as it relates to the S&P 500 or whatever, and you break that stuff down. You find different relationships within a group that some folks just want to call one big monolith. You're doing it this morning on Worth Charting in the banks versus insurance stocks, which is interesting to me because a lot of these companies, they have, you know, similar sort of relationships and the like here and their rate sensitivity and the like and stuff like that. But this is a really interesting note here. And I'm just curious how this came to be, why you wanted to focus on this area. And we'd love to see your work here because it's, to me, I think, you know, insurance is not an area we've spent a lot of time thinking about, but it looks like some interesting trading opportunities here.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, in this case, the work was derived largely for institutional clients because individuals don't really, as you say, maybe think about pairs trade and insurance stocks in general versus banks, getting a little bit of esoteric and so forth. But that was the genesis of it. And we did also make it available to Worth Charting subscribers. And so basically you're talking about a sector, of course, which is about 13% financials. But we know that the sector just almost as those communications is heavily weighted to Berkshire and JP Morgan financials, those being 20% of the entire weight of all. But financials as a sector have banks, and they have investment banks and brokers, and they have insurance stocks. And within insurance, there's property casualty and life health and so forth. And what this effort about from this morning was looking at one area within financials versus another area, as printed there, insurance stocks versus banks, large banks. And so the two aggregates we're looking at are the S&P 500 insurance index versus the BKX, the KBW bank index. And so with that, let's look at some charts. So here we have the insurance index, which is $1 trillion, and it's big names, you know, like Aflac, Quack Quack the Duck, and MetLife, and Prudential, but has Chubb, and Progressive, and Allstate, and AIG, once the, you know, Hank Greenberg, a big, but to my eye, it's steep, increasingly steep, and uncorrected, and far pulling away from its 150-day moving average. By contradistinction, look at BKX. It's the opposite, a heretofore weak, sluggish, worse than that, underperforming area that, however, is curing, healing, recovering, turning, or in my parlance, a bearish to bullish reversal. You see the double bottom, and then you see the smoothing mechanism turning. So let's toggle between those two. Let's just do one extended, the other bottoming. Extended, bottoming. So what if we put them together? There are some good optics. You're looking at a five-year comparative chart of one color versus another, the bank index versus the S&P 500 insurance index. The bank is $2 trillion. The orange line is $1 trillion. Now, one could say, yeah, but you know, you maybe just waited for the time frame to fit. Well, try the next duration. There's 10. Try all data chart. So now with this, one has to say, someone else say, yeah, you're nuts. You play the momentum, you play the one to get even wider. And why would you dig around in banks? They're much more cyclical. They have impaired balance sheets, or they don't, or the government can regulate them. Whereas just selling Chubb insurance is beautiful. Okay, all that, that's on the side. What we know is at some point, lines diverge too much. To my eye, one practitioner, the point here and now is that it's too much. Now let's look at it one other way. So these are comparative lines. Now we look at a ratio chart. So that's one thing divided by another, which gives you a relative strength line. And this is the same duration, but guess what's starting to happen? So we're looking at insurance stocks divided by the bank index. And you can see how it's been a great outperformer on this relative, but look what's happening recently, a little bit of a stall. So let's zero in on the here and now. It has all the hallmarks of a bullish to bearish reversal. The smoothing mechanism is flattening. It's under the line. Put in some other annotations. Could we call it a head and shoulders top? Put in the trend line. Is it at risk of breaking? To my eye. Now, one could say, hey, thanks a lot. How am I going to execute this? I can't get an insurance ETF. The report was written for large institutional clients, long short, mutual funds, family offices, pension plans, and so forth. But most of everything we do, we also make sure is available to Worth Charting subscribers. And so if one says, I can't put this on, okay, then it's academic. If one wants to put it on, perhaps maybe we could do this. If we could pull up a few extended insurance stocks, just to make a point. So Amanda, if you have it, if I could drive for a second, try HIG, Hartford Group, maybe might be something we could look at, and or Progressive. But some of these stocks, and this is the point, I mean, really?
It's a bit.
Really? Okay, how about AIG, another, or take a look at Progressive, PGR, obviously the great Progressive has been a long-term winner. But I mean, to my eye, some of this stuff, I mean, this stock has doubled.
So real quick, Carter, so if we could go back, Amanda, to the 10-year comparative chart, and now given what you've just said about the, you know, the somewhat parabolic moves in the insurers and sort of reading between the lines, you think this probably rectifies itself by the insurers selling off. So although banks can participate to the upside, the more likely scenario is the blue in the form of the insurance, right? The insurance, basically. Is that correct? Am I looking at it correctly?
Yes. And actually, these are good optics, right? The way two colors and two lines. But the true way to look at a relationship, of course, is a ratio chart. And if you look at the final ratio charts, and to Guy's point here, it's already starting to happen. And so this is, again, this is the insurance index relative performance to banks. They've been stalling for almost a year. That peak was in March a year ago. Mm-hmm. And so even as insurers are going up, they're not going up as much as banks. And banks, the absolute pattern, feel they have more room to run. And the insurers feel stretched. So,
okay, last one from me real quick, Dan. Yeah. I'm sorry. But
No.
You know, this sort of plays into your thesis of rates going lower. Because if you think about it, obviously the insurers do well in a higher interest rate environment. And there's probably, you know, a good chance that, you know, listen, you can make the argument that when yields were at their highest, you know, there were some of the better performances out there. So you're of the belief that yields go down. We have a differing view. That's not the point. But this sort of backs up your thesis that if yields, in fact, do move lower, those insurers that have outperformed could actually start to move precipitously lower as well. So I think it all ties into that narrative that you've brought forth.
Hey, so really quickly, and again, I love this stuff because, to be frank, I was not, before I read this report, had spent a lot of time looking at too many of the insurance names, and I had no idea this HIG looked like this. Can we pull up a five-year of the HIG? Carter, you often talk about a measured move. When you think about most of 2021, 2022, and 2023 until it started to break out towards the end, HIG was trading, what, in a $15 range, really between, let's call it, 60 in the high 70s. So here we are. We break out to a new all-time high at 80, Carter, early this year. And here we are at 100. So what happens when you achieve that measured move?
Yeah. I mean, that's just the minimum. A lot of people say go higher. But the main point is, and you've said it, is that we're trying to find inflection points. The breakout is clear. That's the time at which one wants to buy a stock, perhaps the IYT or an index, something that's on the cusp of breaking out. If it doesn't, you take measures. If it does, you stick with it. But at some point, we have price discovery, right? So that, and one can say, it's just rates, Carter. You can see that as soon as rates drop from 5 to where they are now. But did they really drop? They dropped from 501 to 43, and all of a sudden this happens. The point being, we've had the breakout. It is a measured move. It is particularly steep. Okay, so let's say one says, well, I don't want to sell it. All right, well, then buy more. You want to double it? Double up? I mean, the point is, I think you take some measures. And the beauty of pairs trading is that you got a little bit of a hedge. And so that's my thinking.
All right, I got one more.
Sorry, Dan.
No, I got one more guy, because I want to get your take on this too.
Yeah.
LNC. Let's pull up a 1 year, and then I want to look at a 5 year. Because this thing to me, I think we had it in our group chat a week and a half ago. That thing looked like it was poised to break out. Look at that. So this is in the space. Let's look at a 5 year now. I mean, isn't this a CBW, a classic bearish to bullish reversal here? And this is in the insurance space.
Oh, yeah. We did a note on that in September. And again, just last week, saying, hey, this is so asymmetrical. If you're wrong, it just sits here. But if you're right, 33, 10%, 43, 53, forget about the 83, the high. It's very compelling to my
mind. All right. Wait, by the way, nice call. That's me conflating a few things. So I must have read it. I must have read it on Worth Charting. But I saw that thing and I was like, oh my goodness, this could be off to the races. All right, I'll leave it at that.
No, guys. And you also have that gap in the chart. If you go back to October of last year, yeah, that we probably fill. Real quick, Carter, and I'm not suggesting you have any thoughts on this whatsoever, but IAK, I believe, is something that people are asking about. I think that is one of these many the ETFs, and this is an iShares US Insurance ETF. Thoughts?
Perfect. And so if we found it, there you go. My shortcoming, I should have referenced this, put it in the report. IAK is the way to play it. And if we look at, there's a BKX, KBWB, which is an ETF for the bank index. And so actually we have two very pure ways you put it on as a pair.
Yeah, interesting guy. I've not heard of that one. And options trade by appointment. So when I see something like this and I say to myself, all right, well, maybe, you know, we could whip up a little put spread or something like that to find the ranges in which Carter, you know, back a retest. But like I'm looking at the volumes here, it's literally traded like in the next 2 months, like 50 contracts or something like that.
Back in my days on the Mercantile Exchange, there was a potato contract, and potatoes traded by appointment as well, just as an FYI.
We should try, because all of us, I mean, between the three of us, we probably have nearly 100 years of collective experience in the markets, which means that we have heard thousands of horrible jokes, but we have
that's a true. I'm not even making a
joke. Never heard one potato, two potato before.
Yeah, but we've also probably have thousands of like amazing sayings that we've heard over the years, and trade by appointment is a good one. All right, Carter Braxtonworth, we really appreciate
it. All right, team. Thank you.
See you next week, brother.
Guy, yeoman's work. I mean, yeoman's work.
Do you remember like the just the jokes on the desk that you just you know all day long? I mean, it was just and then the crazy sayings too. But
well, the yes, and there were so many fun things that went on. Obviously, that world does not exist anymore, at least not in the same way, for good and for bad, to be honest with you. But yeah, there was some. I mean, there was a lot of fun. And on those quiet Fridays, when you send somebody down to McDonald's with a $100 bill to come back with, you know, whatever. I mean, this is a quick true story. I'm sorry, Amanda, but, you know, this is back in my Drexel days. So this is like 1987, 1988. And it was a Friday. And we sent a kid down with $100, which back then was a lot. It's a lot of money now. It was a lot of money then, to bring back McDonald's. We didn't tell them what to get. And this was a bit of a test, but go and get McDonald's. Now, if you're smart, you get like 30 cheeseburgers, 30 hamburgers, a shitload of French fries. And, you know, that's basically it. You can't really bring back shakes and what have you. This asshole brought back, you know, Filet-O-Fish sandwiches. It's like, really? Suffice to say, and needless to say, he was shown the door. So, you know, you could get a job a lot easier back then. You could lose one for reasons like that. And that's a true story.
Can I ask you a question? Was it Lent? Because, you know, on Fridays.
No, I don't give a shit what it was. There's no reason to buy Filet-O-Fish ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
We once had a kid on the trading desk. I think the guy who ran, it was his firm. He basically said there's probably 20 of us on the desk or something like that. Looked around the desk, who can eat, I think it was 100 chicken McNuggets in like 15 minutes or something like that. One kid, you know, the kid was, whatever the amount of money was, you know, he jumped right up. I could do that in a heartbeat. And he did, whatever the time period, he looked green as can be afterwards. Guy, we got a few more things to get out of here. Maybe we'll take a couple more questions if you guys have them. Saw the consumer confidence. This is one that it's interesting to me. An election year, I keep seeing, you know, stories about how, you know, some of these, you know, feelings about the economy, feeling, you know, about the confidence in this, that, the other thing is really coming down party lines, which I think is kind of interesting. This data seemed a bit mixed, but generally pretty decent here. I think you would probably say it's kind of an overlay of risk assets and the S&P 500 and all that sort of stuff. But future expectations of confidence are kind of trending down a little bit here. But then, Guy, look at this. Let's pull up this chart of RH, the Restoration Hardware. Huge breakout today after a better than expected result here. You know, it seems like for every story that you can find like this, we can find one that's going the opposite way. Thoughts here, because the home improvement trade continues to work.
All right. So the Restoration Hardware story, obviously it got a little ahead of itself way back in the day. The stock was effectively cut in half. And now here we are back on our horse. I mean, this obviously steers towards a certain consumer, and it's sort of the wealthy end of the spectrum. And they came in with what was an okay quarter, but I think it's the environment that we find ourselves in and some of the guidance. And by the way, the fact that their margins seemingly were improving, I think that gave some people some hope. The same side of that equation, if you could pull up a Williams-Sonoma chart, which is a very similar comp in terms of company. I mean, this has been lower left to upper right for quite some time. So you have the one side where, you know, I think people that are doing well continue to do well and continue to spend. Now, the flip side of that coin is sort of, to a certain extent, what we heard from McDonald's for the first time since we've been doing fast money, where people were feeling the pinch at McDonald's. Think about that for a second. That's with the unemployment rate still below 4%. And obviously what we're seeing in the dollar stores. So on one side of the equation, you have people that are strapped and hurting and manifesting itself in the stocks and in the commentaries from the CEOs. And the other side of the coin are names like Restoration Hardware, Williams-Sonoma, and some of the higher-end retailers that are doing extraordinarily well. And I think in terms of the confidence numbers, I want to believe that's why things are so probably confusing, because you have a lot of people that are hurting and a lot of people that are doing really well.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think it was about a couple of weeks ago on the Tape podcast, you and I went back and forth on this a little bit. And so when you're seeing some of these retailers or these quick service restaurants that are speaking to what they're seeing, right? And then you have, you know, on the higher end, as far as retail, you know, just good results, good guidance, you know, investors are, you know, tripping over each other to buy them. What's going on here is that, yeah, inflation has come down, at least CPI, from 9% to 3%. So people shopping at Williams-Sonoma, they don't care. It's not really affecting them a whole heck of a lot. But if you're a lower wage earner, right, that inflation that you're seeing, because all of those companies are raising prices a little bit, their wages are going up and this and that, whatever, the cost of food is, you know, is going up cumulatively year over year, it's getting that much harder. And I think it's really important that you bring that up. Back to Williams-Sonoma for one second here, guy. You would think that this company has been trading a large language model, or just, you know, has a GLP-1 in the pipeline or something like that. You look at this, you know, expectations for earnings this year are mid-single digits, sales low single digits. It only trades at 21 times or so. That is the S&P market multiple, and about 20 times next year. So let me ask you this. If you had any thought that the economy would cool down at some point, you know, paying 21 times for Williams-Sonoma, which seems fair, but maybe not relative to its growth, is probably not a great do, in my opinion. Right. Does that make some sense to you? Or no,
it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I do think, again, if you're going to start to see, if unemployment starts moving in a meaningful way, which it shows no signs of up until that last report, which obviously the rate went from 3.7 to 3.9. But if we start to see a meaningful move upward, at a certain point, even names like Williams-Sonoma are not going to be sort of protected from that. So I think you make a very good point. If you think things are going to slow down, I mean, although this stock may seem cheap now, it gets very expensive very quickly in terms of what could happen. So I don't know if it's necessarily time to pull the ripcord in this or Restoration Hardware, but you have to be aware of what's going on. And I do think that, you know, think about this. For McDonald's to say what they said, and for some of these dollar stores to say what they said, that's saying it with an unemployment rate that's basically at historic lows. Could you imagine what will happen? God forbid the unemployment rate starts to move in a meaningful way up. Obviously, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Yeah, and they're probably pulling up McDonald's right there. I mean, that is not a great looking chart. I mean, it's obviously been in a nice uptrend, but if you look at it down 7% from those recent highs, you see that low at 250 where it got in late 2023. I mean, that stock went from 300 to 250 like that. Okay, mm-hmm. That was a big move for a stock like McDonald's. And I want to just pull up really quickly some other, we'll call them consumer discretionary, not the McDonald's is discretionary, but let's pull up a Starbucks for a second. This is one we spent some time talking about. I know Danny Moses has been bearish on this sort of thing. I mean, look at that underperformance over the last, you know, kind of year or so. Technically, it's sitting on a big level. You could make a case where maybe that's a great level to kind of buy it and have a move back up towards that 200-day moving average or the like. Thoughts on Starbucks? Because this is not just a domestic story. Obviously, it's China and the globe, and then the inflation too. I mean, like the food inflation.
100%. And in order to do this, I mean, we should go longer, you know, take a longer-term chart of Starbucks real quick, and I'm pulling it up here as well. But no, you look at where we are and where we've been. I mean, yeah. Starbucks is a name, I want to say, that made its all-time high again, like a lot of stocks in 2021. And it really has not participated. It's not participated whatsoever in this broader market rally. So I think that is telling you something. You could say it's saturation, the slower growth without question, that premium valuation is no longer deserved. All those are true. The China part of the story, maybe it's somewhat challenged. I get it. But now you look at a name like this, you know, it's telling a story. When a company doesn't participate in a broader market rally to the extent that we've seen, you have to take notice without question. And obviously Starbucks is one of those names. I'll throw another one out there because I know you're going to bring it up. Nike is going to look very similar in terms of, you know, where it was and where it is now. So there you go. Look at that all-time high again. Like many things, 2021, look at where it was, look at where it is now. Just something to keep in mind. And it's not an indictment. It's just an observation.
Yeah. So, Guy, what are we doing to ourselves here? Because, you know, you could just say, if you want to cherry pick this, you could say, well, look at the guys. They just brought up, you know, two of the worst acting in, you know, like consumer discretionary stocks that, you know, have specific reasons, you know, for the, I don't know, man. Like, this is Hoka Nike, seriously. Like, Nike has underperformed the S&P because of Hoka. I don't really buy that. So, you know, to me, I do think it's interesting. It's kind of it's something worth weaving a little bit here, if you will. And we could pull up Apple for a second here, because again, this is kind of the, like, whether you like to think of it this way or not, this is like the epitome of a consumer discretionary stock. You can buy a very cheap Android phone if you like. You can buy Dell laptops. They're much cheaper than that of an Apple Mac, right, Guy? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you're in tune with all those the nifty gadgets there. When you think about this company, you think about their exposure to China, you think about the weakness. That's really been the thing. I think a lot of folks, by the way, think that, you know, much like that quarter in early 2019, it was late 2018, Guy. That's another similarity we could bring up. We can kind of tie a bow on this whole conversation that we started. Apple missed in China big in Q4 2018. And do you remember they issued a warning, yeah, I think on the second day of the year. And that was actually the low of the stock, to be very honest with you. But if you want to look at a five-year chart of where this thing has been and where it is right now, the underperformance of late is might be telling you something more, you know what I mean, about what's in store for A, consumer discretionary, but B, for companies that have U.S. multinationals, a lot of exposure in areas like China where they were expected a lot of their future growth.
Look, and you brought this up. I mean, it's those things coupled with the fact now that the government is sort of on their ass a little bit, this antitrust, non-competitive stuff, which, you know, I think is somewhat folly, but again, it's out there. And then you throw on top of the fact that, you know, they don't seem to have a real idea of what's going on in AI, which again, seemingly you're being punished if you don't seem to have an AI strategy right now. And, you know, the debate is, does Apple have one or not, or are they going to have to sort of acquire one? How does that work? And what does it mean for the install base? But without question, I mean, there's no denying, you know, the stock has traded, what is off, about 13%-ish from its all-time high. Something to sort of keep in mind. And we have seen moves like this before in Apple. It's not immune from sell-offs either. And the fact that, again, you look at that moving average, Dan, that is absolutely flattening out. And, you know, if that thing starts to roll, you know, listen, we've identified a couple levels it should stop at. That's worked a few times since October. Now you're sort of in no man's land in terms of the stock, you know, at this 170 level. So, well, I think you got to watch it very closely, because although it's not a barometer for the broader market lately, I think still in the long run it will be.
Well, there's two things here. So if Amanda can draw a line from that low in 2020, from the COVID low, attach it to the 2022 low, you see where you're going. You're going to 160, okay? So unless they next week guide up, Guy, the stock's going to 160. Okay. So, you know, that's not such a crazy call. The stock's at 171 right here. It's through the 200, like all the stuff that you just said, the stuff with the, you know, the headlines about the government, the DOJ, the EU, none of that's going to let up. They're not going to pull a rabbit out of hat in China. Okay. So the results aren't going to be great. If they don't pre-announce, you might have a little bit of a relief rally. But again, why? Because they don't have a generative AI strategy, to your point. And now you have to wait until June 10th to the Worldwide Developers Forum to get really a broader sort of framework for what they intend to do. But that being said, until they do a deal with, let's say, OpenAI or Alphabet's, you know, Gemini, which was rumored a couple weeks ago, there's nothing to talk about. So in the absence of news, the stock moves lower. And also right now it's being used as a source of funds. So to me, it's not that interesting. But if you were to have a gap lower on China weakness and you get below that 160 and you get back towards that low from 2022, Guy, was about 125. It seems like a long ways away. But to your point, stock sold off 16% from its highs in last year. And then from its highs in 2021 to its lows in 2022, the stock was off 33%.
The third point of that trend line is going to, you know, with each passing day, it gets a little higher, but probably comes in around 155 or so. So that's going to be your next level of support. And, you know, again, Apple, I understand people love Apple. I get it. It sells off too. It actually does have moves to the downside. And again, it has not participated on this broader rally since, you know, you want to say, you can go back actually to middle of last year, or if you want to get a little more specific, since basically October of last year.
All right, one last name before we get to Butters. We had a couple minutes here. We thought we'd take them here, people. Disney. This is one that's kind of interesting. I know that this is one below 100. You made numerous cases on the CNBC's Fast Money, and it was probably even, you know, it's back towards that low that we saw in COVID. You thought it was a bit of a layup, right? Down there. It's a little harder here at 120-ish, guy. You see those levels, that huge long base that we had back then, right? And then we kind of broke out above it, and then COVID happened. And then when everything streaming just ripped, but you've seen what's happened since then. You have this proxy battle going on. There's a date on the calendar, right, where this thing's going to be resolved one way or another. What do you do here? It seems less easy right here at $122.
I think that's exactly right. I think if you look at it, and there, I don't want to say the easy money because that's not fair, but I think the easy part of this trade is probably over. Now you got to start to figure out, you know, what's working for you. Now, what I'll tell you is, for the first time in a while, again, you have moving averages working in your favor, which is a good thing. I mean, that's trading up. The bad news is you have that gap in the chart, as you can see clear as day. So what I think might happen is you're running into a little resistance here. You know, maybe you retrace back down to the mid 103 to 105, and then you take another look. But I think buying it here in the hopes that this basically unabated move since late last year is going to continue, I don't know. I don't see it happening. I think it stalls here more than explodes higher from here.
Yeah, so Carter had a mention to us before we got on the air. He said this is one where if you were long, he'd be selling calls against it, taking in some premium, you know, creating a little buffer to the downside, playing for a little bit of a pullback and trying to help finance that. So that's really interesting. All right, Guy, if it's Thursday on the market call, that means that we take a look at the senior earnings insight analyst work from FatSec. That would be John Butters. Okay, so every Friday morning in your inbox, you can have John Butters' work delivered to you. But what's interesting, Guy, is that you started off this program today talking about quarter end. Well, here we are. In just 2 weeks, we're going to be getting into Q1 earnings season. And I think it's interesting what John is tracking today. He's talking about S&P 500 change in quarterly bottoms-up EPS over the last 3 months. Analysts lowered Q1 EPS estimates for the S&P 500 companies by a smaller amount than average during the first quarter. The bottoms-up EPS estimate for the S&P 500 Q1 decreased by 2.5% during the quarter, smaller than the 5, 10, and 15, and 20-year averages for a quarter. Talk to me about that. Again, we just heard Fed Chair Powell, Guy, last week. They actually ratcheted up their GDP estimates for 2024. Does that all track to you?
It makes sense. I mean, again, John does amazing work. So you could look at it. Here's how one way to look at it. You can say there was not that much enthusiasm for earnings in the first place, which is why instead of lowering estimates, the average, they lowered it basically half the average because so much disappointment to a certain extent had already been built in. So you can look at it through the lens of, wait, they only lowered things by, you know, 2.5% during the quarter, which is, again, is smaller than the average of 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. You can say that's a really good thing. Or you can say expectations were so low that it made sense that it was only lowered that much. Again, depending on your dogma, you can look at this one of two ways. But, you know, go to the next side of this equation. You know, the sectors that continue to do well and the sectors that continue to sort of lag behind. It's the same thing. You know, energy and materials lag and communication services continue to crush.
All right.
And that I think is just part of a theme we've seen now for quite some time.
All right. But here's a really important point. And this is why I think this trend that John's talking about could continue, that if you are, let's call it a real economy company, okay, you're subject to sticky wages, you're subject to higher transportation costs, you're subject to, you know, inflation. You know, we just talked about Starbucks and the like here, so inflationary pressures, which seem to stop going down a little bit. But if you are in communication services, if you're Meta, if you're Google, you don't care about a slowdown in China. You don't care about shipping rates from China, right? Because you're not there for the most part, right? And so if the S&P, and I think we focused on this with John's work last week, you know, if much of the S&P earnings are coming from those top names, that are tech names, right? And might be immune to some of these inflationary pressures, maybe immune to a strong dollar, you know, that's rallied a few percent over the last couple of months. So that's the flip side of that. Does that make some sense? Especially when you look at that, that second chart, when you're looking at the sectors, like to your point, that some are doing well and some are not.
100%, like it's two different economies. It's sort of the old real economy, which seems to be struggling, and it's its new sort of, you know, obviously technology, AI economy that seemingly can't be stopped. And I think that's sort of the dichotomy that we're seeing here. But, you know, again, you have to make the determination. Are we in this new paradigm? Is our economy now predicated solely on technology and the sort of the wish of AI and what it can do? Or, you know, are things sort of the same way they've ever been? And it's just being sort of, I guess, veiled by the new shiny object on the street. And, you know, you can look at this chart. I mean, again, we can talk about it all you want, and it speaks to exactly that when you look at this, Dan.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, you guys know where to get it. We get a preview of John Butter's work, the Senior Earnings Insight Analyst over at FactSet on Thursday's market call right here. But you can also get it to your inbox, insight.factset.com/subscribe. So go do that. All right, Guy. You know what?
One question real quick.
All right.
Because, yeah, I know we're running late, so I apologize. But Ed Morgan asking, Guy, Dan, should I place trailing stops on my gold miner stock? So, obviously, the GDX, I mean, again, I can't speak to exactly what you have, but the GDX has effectively gone from, I want to say, 25 and change in late February to current level 32. So it's been a big move. If Amanda will pull up a GDX chart real quick, you'll see this 32 level-ish in the GDX has been resistance a number of different times. So we're getting up towards theoretically where resistance would be. But to answer your question specifically, yeah, now's the time to start to raise your stop. So again, I don't know where it was originally, but now's the time you start to stair step up in terms of trailing stop. Of course, the good news with trailing stops is you move things up, so you again mitigate your risk. The bad news is the more you move things up, the more prone you are to getting stopped out at some point on something you don't see coming, which is fine. Obviously, it's a high-class problem, so you got to be careful as to how high you raise it. But yeah, I think raising the stop, if it, again, we're talking about just the GDX, to maybe somewhere right below the 200-day moving average, which probably comes in around, I don't know, 27.90, 28. Yeah. That probably makes sense. I hope I answered your question.
Well, you did. Hey, here's another one, because we did this on March 12th on Market Call. We detailed a bullish trade idea in the GDX ETF, Guy, using options. The ETF was trading around 29.55, and we were buying the April 30-34 call spread. So it was slightly out of the money. It cost about 90 cents. So I'm looking at it right now with the GDX at 31.70. I'm looking at April expiration. The 30 call is about 210. The 34 call is about 30 cents. Guy, you can do that math.
$1.80. It's a double.
It's a double. What do you do with a double in an options trade, Guy?
I think if, again, this is how I look at it, but if you've doubled something in an options trade, if you were to sell half of your position, you're in the rest for free. Now you could say, okay, that's fine. Or you could say, you know what, I only want to take a quarter off. But when you've doubled something in that period of time, it's incumbent upon you to do something to move your feet. So again, the math suggests on a double, if you take half off, you're riding the rest, you're in it for the trade for free. That's fine. Take off a quarter, a third, two-thirds, whatever it is, but you got to do something here, Dan.
Yeah, the last point I want to make and why we detailed an options trade here, we thought that options premiums looked kind of reasonable. The ETF just had that huge move from 26 to 29 and a half. So you can do the math on that. That was about, you know, more than 10% or so. So the idea of like defining your risk to about 90 cents made a lot of sense. So now you have a double here. And I think that was a great question. And I'm glad we got to dovetail it with the trade idea and talking, you know, how to manage an options trade too, because that one made some sense to me. So good on you guys.
Good on you. So it's almost 2 o'clock on the East Coast. In approximately 2.5 hours, the Yankees of New York will take on the Astros of Houston in Houston for a 4-game set. For you Met fans, all three of you out there, I'm looking out the window. Oh, it's just gray. I don't see a lot of rain. But yesterday, the Mets postponed today's game. In typical Met fashion, you know, I could have told you yesterday that based on that, it wasn't going to rain today. But hey, I'm a hater, I know. But the Rangers play tonight in Colorado. two of the best teams in hockey, one of the best teams in the West, clearly one of the best teams in the East, face off. So watch that. A lot of sports over the next few hours. So, and you got the NC2A Sweet 16 games as well.
Yeah,
you must be happy about
it. You must be bummed, though. You're not going to be able to make the prop bets. I know that there were some guys that you were looking to make some prop bets. That's why the DraftKings got killed yesterday. Do you see that? Like, so the NCAA wants to ban prop betting.
You know what? Betting on college athletes, yeah. Absolutely. I think it's the guy that runs the NC2As was the former Republican governor of the state of Massachusetts. And I think he's correctly trying to get in front of some stuff. Of course, the problem is, this is a state by state thing. So sort of get it mandated on a federal level is going to be difficult. But making prop bets on 19 year old kids, there's something inherently wrong with that, I think. But what do I know?
No, I'm with, especially in this age of NIL and now that you have so much of this stuff. I mean, like, I think if you're 19 years old and you got money coming from, you know, you don't know where some of this money is coming from here and you don't know what the expectations are. You know, it seems a little dicey. So I'm with you, guy.
That's it. I want to thank the great Carter Braxton Worth. Obviously, John Butters of FactSet. Soon it will be April, and at the end of April, we will be in Miami, Florida. That's Dan Nathan. That is myself. We will be at the FactSet Focus Conference. That's going to be fun. We are looking forward to that. Thank you, folks. Enjoy your day. Tomorrow is a holiday. We'll catch you all on Monday.
See you.